Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigh. It's good to have all of you with us for today's show. And it's an all-journalist panel today, which I love. I mean, it's really good to have my colleagues in the world of journalism talking about politics on this show. That means Greg Bluestein on Wednesdays. He is almost always here as my partner in this. You know he's a political reporter for the AJC and spending a lot of time now. You've been doing legislative coverage, but now more and more getting involved in covering the gubernatorial race and other statewide races.
The primaries are only 2 months away as of tomorrow.
Yeah, we've talked about that a number of times, how surprising it seems to us that the primaries are going to be coming up so quickly. Kyle Wingfield is also in the studio today. He's a columnist for the AJC. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays. Thank you for being here, Kyle.
Always happy to be here.
We're really happy that joining us out of the Washington Bureau of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Tamar Hallerman, Washington reporter for the AJC. Hey, Tamar, how are you?
Hello. Traverse the Arctic tundra to be here.
How many inches of snow do you have in Washington today?
It's not so bad. Only about 2, but they say there could be 6 to 8.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Have fun. Welcome to spring. We want to remind you all that if you think listening to us is entertaining, informative, whatever, just imagine getting to watch us as we do the radio show. We're on Facebook Live. Go to the GPB News Facebook page, and you'll see the video here, how we do a radio show. Tamar, I thought you had the funniest tweet of the week to us. When you tell everybody what you tweeted about in terms of this Facebook Live while you're up there in Washington.
I told Bill the only way I would do this show is if they beamed me in like a hologram.
What? Y'all don't see her over there?
I told Kyle tomorrow before we went on the air that my vision of that is that we'll have a little hologram of you in the middle of our table tomorrow, and we'll have you saying, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope."
A cardboard cutout will do too, and you couldn't even do that, Bill.
I drew a picture.
All right, we've got a lot of ground to cover today. And Tamar, I'd really like to start with you because you had a really interesting piece in the AJC this morning. You started looking at Democratic candidates for Congress in Georgia running against incumbent Republicans and how they're lining up in terms of Nancy Pelosi. This is another shockwave from the Connor Lamb Democratic victory in Pennsylvania. But let's talk about it from the point of view of your article. Go ahead. Tell us about it.
Well, Connor Lamb is more of a moderate Democrat who won a surprising victory in the Pittsburgh suburbs last week. And he did it by running an anti-Nancy Pelosi platform. And he still won. He still got support from the party. And I'm wondering, are, you know, Democratic challengers in Georgia looking to take a page from that same playbook? And I was surprised at how many indicated they would. Almost half of the candidates who are running in suburban Atlanta against Karen Handel and Rob Woodall, two Republican incumbents, say they don't want Nancy Pelosi. They're ready for new leadership. And many others told me they're kind of backing away, or at least planning to keep her at arm's distance. So it's pretty shocking rebuke of your party's leader.
You have a quote from Kevin Abel, who is one of the Democratic candidates running in the 6th District, Karen Handel's district. "While I salute Leader Nancy Pelosi for her decades of service to our country and our party, I believe people are tired of business as usual in Washington and that new leadership is desperately needed in both parties," says Kevin Abel to Tamar Hallerman. What do you think, Greg and Kyle?
Well, look, Karen Handel, who won, of course, the 6th District last year, telegraphed to every imperiled Republican. She's spoken to Republican meetings all over the country and said she ran on an anti-Nancy Pelosi platform, tying John Ossoff to Nancy Pelosi at every opportunity she got. And John Ossoff really struggled with that question. He would always say a variation of, "Well, I'm focused on my district," or "I haven't really thought about what I'd do with Nancy Pelosi." She used that against him, and so did outside groups who ran millions of dollars worth of ads, that San Francisco money and the Golden Gate Bridge was coming to Atlanta with this Ossoff race.
Right.
And so now you're seeing Democrats actively distance themselves from Nancy Pelosi, really in Georgia for one of the first times, aside from John Barrow.
Right. Well, and you know, it reminds me of some things we used to see within the Republican Party when they were already in power. running to say, well, people not necessarily wanting to pledge their support to John Boehner, or, you know, saying, well, I think we might, some very similar sort of things. Well, I think we might need some new leadership. I would point out, I don't think, I'm not sure any of the ones who made it there from Georgia anyway, ever actually followed through with that and voted against the overwhelming favorite of their party once they got to Washington. So these pledges and tap dances are a little hard to believe in some ways.
And Tamar, the question becomes, and I throw this out to all three of you, really, but Tamar, why don't you start us on this? Is that an effective strategy for peeling, among others, is that a starting point for peeling away potential Republican voters to vote Democratic? I mean, it did work for Conor Lamb. What do we think about it as a strategy in Georgia?
I think it is a start for sure. We did polling on Nancy Pelosi ahead of the 6th District special election last year, and we found that almost 60% of voters in the 6th disliked her. So perhaps if you're a Democrat trying to make the case to independents, to moderates, to Republicans unhappy with Trump, perhaps saying, you know, I really hate this polarizing leader, or at least I'm not going to support her, maybe that is a way in. And it takes away from Karen Handel and her allies, one of the key planks of her message.
Yeah, I talked to Democratic strategists about this just this morning, and they said, why give the argument? Why give them that, you know, that piece of ammunition, especially for newcomer candidates that don't have a long history in the Democratic Party? And that's most of these 10 or 11 candidates who are running in 6th and 7th. A lot of them are first-time candidates that don't have that tradition of being a party loyalist, who are somewhat new to the party. They don't feel like they need to sort of cozy up to Nancy Pelosi. So why bother saying that they're going to support her when they can just kind of distance?
So, Kyle, I'm hearing from both of them, you may take this issue away from the Republicans. That doesn't necessarily mean you're going to bring bring voters to your column.
Yeah, I think you have to wonder how credible this kind of argument is. And let's say people do believe that you won't vote for Nancy Pelosi specifically. How many people in a district like Georgia 6 or Georgia 7 think that whoever's coming right up behind Nancy Pelosi into a leadership role like that is going to be any better? I mean, you're really running. If you're the Republicans, you're running against the national Democratic image, and that's still going to be a winner in this state, I think.
That's what strikes me, that I get why Nancy Pelosi has become a totem of all that's wrong with liberal Democrats from the Republican point of view. But taking her off the table, it's still the Democratic Party with a Democratic agenda. So.
Steny Hoyer is not that much better to the average voter in Georgia 6, I think, than Nancy Pelosi or whoever would come after.
So just for a historical footnote, I moved to Georgia in 1983, and the first election that I covered down here in 1984, congressional election, one of the arguments was I came from Chicago. And one of the arguments that Republicans here and around the country were using, had first vote they'll cast is for Tip O'Neill as Speaker of the House. Well, being a Chicago guy, when I heard that, I thought, well, yeah, that makes sense to me. But, of course, back then, Tip O'Neill was the Nancy Pelosi to Republicans. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't change.
No, but the argument for the arms length Democrats is that Steny Hoyer might also be branded tarred with that sort of attacks later on. But that Nancy Pelosi has become so toxic, and we saw it firsthand here last year. John Ossoff was asked about it over and over and over again. He could never really find an effective answer to the attacks that he was going to be Nancy Pelosi's quote-unquote puppet in Georgia. Now you at least have some candidates trying to, neutralize those attacks before they come.
Tomorrow,
exactly. How many people actually know who Steny Hoyer is in Georgia? It just takes away a very easy offensive argument that the Republicans can take.
Tamar, you're up there on the Hill all the time. What do you hear when, not just from the Georgia delegation, of course, but as people talk about the chances, say, for Democrats to make some gains in this state, say in the 7th District, Rob Woodall's mostly Gwinnett County district, which is becoming purple, maybe even a Democrat in the 6th, although that seems a little tougher. What are people saying about Georgia? Do they see it in play, or do they think it's going to remain a red state?
It's kind of like an aspirational goal, right? For Democrats, what they're really looking at right now, the prime targets are Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York. They see the redistricting plan that was approved in Pennsylvania. You know, they're like licking their chops. Those are easy grabs. Georgia is something, you know, it would be nice for them to win this year, but I don't think anybody realistically thinks this would be an easy thing for them to grab any of those Georgia districts this year.
All right. Greg and Kyle, we've been talking primarily about the 6th district and the 7th district as at least possible Democratic places where they can make inroads. But I've been getting messages, emails, tweets from some of our listeners saying you really ought to be paying attention to some of the other races, the 10th district, for instance. I appreciate the input. But I don't know that I really – are there other districts I'm missing out there, Kyle, that might have a chance for Democrats to take over?
Not the 10th.
Yeah.
I don't think at all. I'm just trying to think, not in terms even so much of who's running, but just the district itself.
Just the district demographics.
I mean – maybe in a vacuum, we'd look at somewhere like the 1st,
yeah.
maybe the 8th. Yeah. But I just, honestly, I don't see it.
And he's almost speechless, Greg.
Yeah, he is.
You're asking the impossible.
No, I understand.
But the difference this year, though, and we've mentioned this before in state house races, but also it applies to congressional races, Democrats are lining up in big, huge numbers not seen in a decade or more to run for these congressional seats as well. And incumbents that didn't have challengers 2 years ago, 4 years ago, 6 years ago, now have not just one, but in some cases two, three, or four. And in the 6th and 7th race, you know, multiple.
Yeah, the other factor here, though, is, you know, Georgia 6, we all are thinking about a congressional race that is top of mind. Let's not forget that when we get to November, probably the race most people will hear the most about, see the most ads about, will be the governor's race. Mm-hmm. There is a top-of-the-ticket race here that is going to draw a lot of the attention and a lot of the sort of partisan fervor, and unless the Democrats can find a way to be really competitive in that, that's going to hurt their chances down the ballot, I think.
All right. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say these primary battles in some of these congressional races are also are worthy of watching, too, even if the Democrats still face long shot bids. And the 10th district is a great one. That's Jody Heiss, who is in a very pro-Trump district. He's a very conservative-leaning district. And two candidates who are both running to outflank each other on the left. One is running as a very liberal, and one is running almost as a socialist. I mean, he calls for a universal wages,
yeah,
is running. And so that's sort of one of those sort of litmus tests for where the Democratic Party is going.
Before we move on to the next subject, I want to remind you all that you should join our conversation by tweeting us. We're at PoliticsGPB, PoliticsGPB. The other day, I acknowledged that I have gotten away from giving our Twitter handle, and I can't do that. I am getting exhorted by our producers, keep pumping Twitter. So tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and we will look at your tweets and see if we can put some of your comments. We want your feedback, so give it to us. Or write comments to us on the Facebook Live if you're watching there. All right, let's... Kyle, Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant signed into law the other day a bill which would create what is being called the most restrictive abortion law in the United States. It's a law that would disallow abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. A federal court has now stayed that order for 10 days while they look it over. But the reason it's relevant to us here today, of course, is that Brian Kemp, a GOP candidate for governor, has already said, hey, I'm all for it. It's the same thing I'll push for if you elect me governor. How does that play, and what do we think about this?
Well, you know, it's interesting to me that, I believe it's right that it would be the most restrictive in the United States. I looked back across the pond to my own stomping grounds in Europe, and you look over there, our laws across the board look downright permissive compared to what's allowed there. I mean, in Belgium, where I lived, you can euthanize your child, but you cannot have an abortion for any reason after 12 weeks after conception. So, to the 15-week thing, I think, gets portrayed as extreme, and you compare to some other countries that we often compare ourselves to, and maybe it's not. But it was interesting to me that Kemp went there, and then you immediately had Michael Williams going to six or eight.
Another Republican candidate for governor.
And honestly, as long as we're making up numbers that are never going to pass the General Assembly, why stop at six? I don't know how much of a constituency there would be in the legislature, like I said, for passing a law like that. But I don't think it necessarily hurts him in a Republican primary.
All right. Okay, that's an interesting point. In a Republican primary.
Last four words matter there.
Yes, they do. Tomorrow, here's a Republican Party, certainly around the country at least, struggling, we have seen in recent elections, to hold on to female voters, especially suburban female voters. They cost Republicans that seat in the 18th in Pennsylvania. They cost Republicans the Alabama Senate seat of Jeff Sessions. They cost the Republicans a good shot at winning the Virginia governor's race. So, okay, let's move beyond Kyle. If Brian Kemp or a Michael Williams who support this kind of restriction make it through to the general, how are women voters? How does this help Republicans attract female voters?
I mean, as you see time and time again, though, you know, you move to your base for, you know, ahead of your primary, and then you very quickly pivot and move toward the center. So I expect immediately whoever's going to end up in this, in this general will immediately turn back and not be talking about such divisive issues in order to win, voters in the center.
And by the way, let's be clear. I mean, not only did Brian Kemp, the Secretary of State, say that he'd match Governor Bryant, but he said he'd go even a step further and pass even more restrictions on abortion. And it wasn't just Williams who echoed him. It was Hunter Hill and Clay Tippins both, before the day was done, both also said they would too back what Governor Phil Bryant did in Mississippi. The exception, though, was Casey Cagle, who said, I stand by what I've already done on abortion, and that includes Georgia's abortion laws, which restricts most abortions after 20 weeks. And that's sort of where you kind of started to see the dividing line. In these last few weeks of the Republican primary, you're seeing a lot of candidates try to outdo each other on the right flank with even more sort of headline-grabbing proposals. Cagle's trying to draw the line on that, I think. He had his own Delta NRA position. But beyond that, he's in the 30s or 40s in polls. He's in good position. He might go for, the knockout blow trying to win it outright. But beside that, he's also kind of looking at the general election a little bit more now.
Well, and we might look at those who jump out immediately on issues like this as those who think that they are in the most need of a boost or some momentum as we come down the stretch. They're trying to get a spark, I think that's probably fair to say.
And he addressed that, I think, in a sort of sideswiping way in
Who's
his
he?
First ad. Casey Cagle.
Ah.
He had his first ad come out today, and it says something to the effect of, the real leaders lead, they don't just talk.
Wait, why don't we let the ad speak for itself? Greg Bluestein, here is that Casey Cagle ad.
Political talkers may mean well, but leaders get things done. I'll always stand for our families and our conservative values. While I appreciate the encouragement, results require decisive actions. That's why I led the fight for one of the toughest crackdowns on illegal immigration that outlawed and defunded sanctuary cities, and I will hold them accountable to help law enforcement protect our loved ones from criminal illegal aliens.
Conservative Casey Cagle leads.
All right, I love that spot for a couple of reasons, and you all can weigh in. But without naming anybody, I think I hear in the first case, talk is one thing, leadership is another. I think that's probably an indirect shot at Michael Williams, is the way I read it. The talk about immigration, clearly a shot across the bow at Brian Kemp. Am I missing anything in here?
And of course, Kemp has emphasized illegal immigration in his campaign, especially in his first ads as well.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to watch this race, and I'm fascinated by the fact that you said that maybe the Cagle people are still potentially looking to do this thing without a runoff. And we're going to be talking a lot about
outside
that.
Outside shot, but outside. Who knows?
All right. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we've got more about a state issue, a legislative issue that has also made its way. We've already referred to it into the gubernatorial race. But you're listening to Political Rewind and you're watching us on Facebook Live. We'll be right back.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows, you're all sealed inside, take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported this station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Machine smell. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman is in our Washington Bureau. She's got her snow boots on, I imagine. You've gotten a couple of inches and possibly more to come. So thank you for – are you in the Cox Bureau or are you in your cozy office in the Capitol at 400 – where are you?
I am in the U.S. Senate.
Oh, okay. You are. Oh, very
waiting
impressive.
Waiting for them to vote on this spending bill that we haven't seen yet.
So as long as you mentioned it, let's just address that quickly. The deadline is Friday to get a new spending bill out. And am I correct, Tamar, that they've suspended timing rules so that the Senate can move this bill – hopefully, as you said, perhaps today, the House can get to it tomorrow. Am I right about that?
We're actually scrambled. So we're waiting for the bill to come out. The House will take it up first.
Of course. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And they like to do, this is a custom, not a rule. They like to have 3 days after a bill comes out to vote on it. It sounds like they don't want to do that. They want to get out early. So they're hoping to vote on it tomorrow, send it to the Senate so the Senate can vote under the wire. But as we've seen in the past, Rand Paul a few months ago forced a shutdown of a few hours because he was objecting. That could very well happen again this weekend.
I have to go back to my How a Bill Becomes Law classes and remember that all spending bills start in the House, not in the Senate. Thank you for reminding me of that, Tamar. A couple of tweets, and then we'll move on. We have a tweet from Rhea, who says, I'm looking for it now, Rhea Booth, she says, anyone that the Republicans use against us should be replaced with a more likable candidate. She's clearly a Democrat. Nancy Pelosi is doing Democrats no favor by refusing to retire. Her district has no problem electing another Democrat who would be younger and more innovative. We have a bunch of quotes, a bunch of tweets from many of you, and I'll try to get to some more of them in a little while. One of them, as long as it's here, and this is on our agenda for today, Monday's Child says, you must talk about odious Senate Bill 403. There are people who are demanding the bill be killed. Do we have to draw national attention to this travesty? It's anti-democratic and bordering on treason. This is the bill to replace the current touchscreen voter machines with something that will leave some sort of paper trail, Greg. I haven't heard it referred to as anti-democratic in many ways, but I know there's a lot of criticism and a lot of opposition mounting.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the biggest debates left in the last couple of days of the legislative session. There seems to be a consensus among Republicans and Democrats that the voting machines need to be scrapped and replaced. They're running on outdated software that can't even be updated because it runs on a Windows 2000 platform that's no longer serviced. There's issues, and there seems to be another consensus that there needs to be some sort of paper formatting, paper backup, paper balloting, whatever it might be. What election integrity experts and Democrats are most concerned about is that the format of that paper, of whether or not it will be a true paper balloting system. And they're worried that without that, there won't be a true backup. And the supporters of this bill are saying that it paves the way for paper, some version of paper, but doesn't explicitly say what that paper backup would look like.
I do think we have to point out, because Kyle, I've gotten a lot of people contacting me about this. There are a lot of people who think they know what this bill requires in the way of voting machines. But the fact of the matter is, the language of the bill is such that it leaves it open for further examination of what would be the best paper machine with the best paper trail. So it isn't as if they're locking in, but the concerns are they're going to lock into the wrong form.
Yeah, the idea is to provide guidelines for what the new system needs to accomplish, but not be prescriptive as to exactly what it needs to be. And that's been true from the beginning. I remember speaking with the legislators last year before the session got started, and that was their intention. You know, the other controversy that I've picked up on is when it would be in place or when they would start, you know, having the RFP for this. And there, I don't know that there's necessarily a lot of consensus. I hear people saying, well, we need it in place as soon as we can because elections could be stolen. But then you hear, on the other hand, like, well, if we rush this, we may get it wrong. So I don't know that there's a firm feeling as to how soon this new system needs to be in place.
Yeah, we certainly we're not talking about new machines for the 2018 cycle, maybe 2020 at the soonest.
Yeah, but even that, I hear some people saying, well, it's too soon. So I guess it depends on your perspective and how quickly you think this can happen.
We got a tweet tomorrow that I want to share with you because I asked you the question about it. Starlighter Ember tweets, love your show, thank you. The restrictive abortion bill you're speaking of may help the GOP in their primaries, but this suburban mom is definitely not going to vote for anyone who goes there, which tomorrow goes to the point that I asked you about. You know, is this a good general election issue for a Republican to take on?
Yeah, and I'm not expecting them to talk a ton about abortion as we get closer to the general election. Certainly it'll be a background issue.
Yeah,
And
Catherine Cummings, who tweets us, says women will always find a way to end a pregnancy. FYI, I don't think people, she's commenting on you, euthanize their children, but in fact, you're talking about a law.
It is legal, and maybe I have the actor, but a child can request it or something. But children, it is legal in Belgium for children to be euthanized. So,
okay, let's go back. I said there was another issue that's come up in the legislature, another bill that has found its way into the gubernatorial race. Greg, that's the immigration bill, which the Senate. It started in the Senate, I believe. And it's a bill that would require we've seen this before in other forms in other states. It would require local law enforcement to participate with ICE in rounding up. When an arrest is made, it would require local law enforcement to determine whether that person who has been arrested is an undocumented resident and then cooperate to turn that person over to ICE. It's very controversial, mm-hmm. but the Senate passed it. Now the House has watered it down in committee, at least.
Yeah, and this bill, not only did it say that police officers must detain unauthorized immigrants, but also it said it must transport them to federal detention centers.
Yeah.
Now it replaces a shall, which would require them to do that, with a may, which basically takes the teeth out of the bill. And there's a few candidates in the Senate, including Michael Williams, who's running for governor, who were very upset about that change, saying that it basically made the bill toothless.
Well, and also, again, Brian Kemp, who has been already out there saying he's going to be as tough on immigration as you can possibly get. The other aspect of this bill that's fascinating is it would require judges to look through their dockets and determine who and who is not here illegally, and they would have to then report out on this. And Kyle, some of the judges are already pushing back and saying, what, we don't have enough to do already?
Well, and that's where some of the opposition to this bill in general comes from, right, is, okay, you're putting mandates on us, unfunded mandates, you might say, when you're talking about transporting someone or researching their background more or, you know, changing the way you work your docket as a judge. So, I'm sure there are people who are very much against illegal immigration who still don't see this bill as necessarily being the kind of thing they want to deal with as law enforcement.
Okay. Let's move on. why don't we take just a second? Tomorrow, I don't know if you've had a chance to read our colleague Jim Galloway's column, but Galloway wrote a piece that appeared in the paper. It appeared online yesterday, and I think it's in the paper, hard paper today, the Dead Tree edition today. And basically what he said is that these problems that Stacey Abrams is reporting now to have in terms of her financial statements, the debt that she's in, the $50,000 she owes to the IRS, the high credit card debt, Galloway makes the point that being in debt and having difficulties with your finances doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to be elected because he points out that Nathan Deal went through a much more serious problem when he ran the first time out. He had, in an effort apparently to do the best he could for his children, made a $2 million loan to try to bail out a sporting goods store that went kind of south. But now the governor's, in pointing that out, the governor's chief of staff, Chris Riley, has tweeted, doesn't understand why Galloway is bringing this sort of thing up. What's wrong with your colleague Galloway? Tamar's got nothing to say about that.
I mean,
where does the list begin?
Yeah, what's wrong with Galloway? Goodness gracious.
I mean, one thing to say, though, is just to look now at, you know, what's going on in Washington. You have a president who was elected without releasing his tax returns. Yep. We don't know the intricacies of his financial situation. And initially, people were saying, oh, this is a game changer. People won't want to vote for him. And he's sitting in the Oval Office. So I think with that context, this stuff with Stacey Abrams doesn't feel as severe as it would have been 20 years ago.
So here's the exact tweet from the governor's chief of staff, Chris Riley. This coming from the same paper that alleged, quote, if he can't manage his own finances, how can he manage the states in 2010? How do the state's finances look? AAA rating, $2.3 billion in rainy day fund, and consistently conservative budget. So it's a strong comeback, but unfortunately he makes the point for Stacey Abrams, Greg.
And the argument from some of Abrams' critics right now is that it's different. Even though Governor Deal owed more money, he didn't owe federal tax dollars, he didn't owe it. So you know, he didn't. It wasn't on his financial disclosures. And by the way, it was about $4 million plus when the whole tally was for the debts that Governor Deal owed. Period. But the worry from some Democrats, especially the Evans camp, even though Stacey Evans is not speaking publicly about it, but from some of her supporters who are, is that this will just be used aggressively by Republicans in August or September or October with essentially an attack ad that says she wants to raise your taxes but won't pay hers or some variation of that that will resonate. And then the counter to that, it's not just Governor Deal, by the way. It also came up big in Keisha Lance Bottoms' campaign for mayor when she was questioned about her failure to pay water bills and other debts. And she made the argument that she was doing her best for her family when she was trying to start her family, have a child. And she made that in a way that it kind of silenced some of the criticism about her from her opponents.
Yeah, I got to say, Kyle, I'm not convinced. I mean, I sort of kind of come down with Galloway on this. I'm not I certainly understand how Republicans in a general election campaign would try to use this against her. I'm not convinced it's going to be an issue that will rise. If Olivia Rheingold, our producer, went out and did a man on the street, woman on the street about this, how serious a problem do you think this is? Will you vote against her because of it? I doubt they're going to. I just wonder how many people are going to say, that's it. That's my issue.
Well, obviously, it's going to depend in any case on how it's portrayed, right? And I do think the fact that it is taxes that are portrayed, I think it makes it a little qualitatively different. And it's also going to depend on who the opponent on the Republican side is and whether they have anything, you know, along those lines or have always mm-hmm. been very financially mm-hmm. sound. You know, they'll be better able to make that contrast if they haven't had any problems like this.
And Stacey Abrams has been very aggressive in responding to that. I went to an event over the weekend at the Young Democrats of Georgia, where she addressed it at the very beginning, near the beginning of her speech. She said, shocking, I'm human. And, you know, the folks on the other side of the issue, the Evans supporters, would say, well, you know, she's in her mid-40s and she's worked for years as a tax attorney, you know, so this sort of debt isn't that normal. The Abrams people say that it's a sign of someone who's trying to struggle to make it to the middle or upper class, and that debt is sort of endemic, and that just shows that she's like us. She's a normal human being.
All right. I want to take up an issue of a story that has literally just moved. And Tamar, I'm going to come to you on this, although because it is brand new, you may not have had a chance. And you've been sitting in your office there. This is a report that I don't know if it originated with The Hill, but The Hill is reporting it. Republican leaders have agreed to include a provision in the government funding package clarifying that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is not barred from conducting gun violence research under a 1996 Amendment. That, if we go back to 96, when in fact Congress, and I believe the Clinton White House, although I would want to check to be certain of that, told CDC stop doing gun research. Not since then has CDC moved forward in looking at data on guns. If this now says we never intended for you to not do research, it's a big breakthrough, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And Congress has gotten close in recent years to repealing this ban on the CDC doing gun research, but they've never gotten there. But I will say that Republicans have been under immense pressure since the Parkland shooting to do something, since they're in control of all levers of government here in D.C., to do anything to address what happened in Florida. So probably by including this, this is moving the needle, they'll say. There's also talk that there is a registration bill or something that John Cornyn was pushing related to guns that will also be in the bill. I can try and get the details on that. But overall, pretty narrowly kind of tailored changes, but still enough to say, we're doing things. We're trying to move forward and address.
And there's a little Georgia twist to this, too. Earlier this year, Stacey Evans running for governor, said that she would direct a sort of state-level research into this as well if the feds can't move on it. And so you're already seeing it sort of help shape the Georgia Democratic race for governor.
Well, there's yet another Georgia twist on this. Back in 1996, when CDC was doing data research on guns, that effort was being led by a scientist named Dr. Mark Rosenberg. Rosenberg refused to honor the prohibition, insisted he was going to continue researching guns. It's become a passion of his ever since. He was fired by the feds when he refused to stop doing his gun research. And so there are a number of interesting Georgia angles on this thing. Let's do this. Why don't we get our final break of the show out of the way? We still have plenty to talk about, and you've been sending us some terrific tweets. We will get to all that when we come back. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, comic and Daily Show correspondent Roy Wood Jr. He also hosts the Comedy Central storytelling series This Is Not Happening and recently had a stand-up special.
But if we get rid of the Confederate flag, how am I going to know who the dangerous white people are?
Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind, our all-journalist panel, our all-AJC journalist panel with us today. Tamar Hallerman in the Washington Bureau of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. She's in the U.S. Senate to talk with us today. Kyle Wingfield, who is, as we point out frequently, listed as a columnist from the right, which is the way the paper likes to break things down. There are columnists from the left and columnists from the right, and you're one of those right-wingers.
Yes, right wing nut, I've even been called.
And Greg Bluestein, who I've said this many times, and I think it continues to be true, who has more bylines in a given week than probably any other reporter for a newspaper in the United States. I don't know how you are so prolific.
They keep us busy downtown.
Yeah, I get that. By the way, let's plug. You've got another new job, as if you don't have enough to do already. All of the stories you write coming in here on Wednesdays. You're now doing a podcast.
Yeah, it's called Politically Georgia. It's usually out every Monday. We might see if we can update the frequency to it later on.
Oh, my gosh. Who knows? You keep asking for more work.
it's me and some guests every week. This week's guest will be James Salzer. We're going to talk about Sine Die. We're going to have Tamar on soon to talk about the congressional races and all that sort of fun.
Salzer, of course, among other things, is your money guy at the Capitol.
He's our budget guru.
He knows more about the budget than anybody else except for the chairs of the Senate and House budget committees, I think.
I've seen the governor and his chief of staff, Chris Riley, ask James questions about their own budget. So.
Let me read a few tweets. J.P. Cunningham says, late Thomas Foley was a magnificent U.S. House Speaker, bright, pleasant, fair but firm, and not a lightning rod like Nancy. I miss him. We can have similar. Sam Burnham says, from the right, talking about Abrams, they need to run against Abrams' policies, not her personal finances. I suspect all three of us would agree on that point. We have a tweet from Akan Ben, who says, I think ours will find it a lot easier to give someone rights than to take them away. The right to terminate a pregnancy is a Pandora's box that will never be closed. Ours know this. These mostly inconsequential skirmishes are the death knell of a declining ideology. Wow, that's a declining ideology. But, you know, you in a sense referred to that. You said you can put whatever arbitrary number of weeks on this, and but it's not going to pass. Why isn't it ever going to pass?
Well,
more restrictions on abortions.
Yeah. I think most Republicans will tell you they're against abortion. Now, what does that mean to them? And it doesn't always mean the same thing to everybody. And so you get into, once you get into the specifics of it means this or that, that's when you start to get disagreement. I'm not saying nothing will ever pass, but it tends to be tweaking around the edges rather than a big jump in one direction.
Okay. I got one thing to add about the abortion debate, too. It seems earlier Casey Cagle's campaign staffers were also listening, and I got a text saying essentially he's not keeping one eye on the general election. He just was trying to send the signal that you're not going to outflank us on the abortion issue. Look at his record, which includes support for the ban on most abortions after 20 weeks. So that's just to clarify, that's from their point of view.
All right. Let's move on. Let's talk about some visitors to the state. The vice president's going to be here on Friday night. He's going to be the keynote speaker at the annual Republican Party state party dinner. What do they call that dinner these days?
Is it victory dinner?
Victory dinner.
I think that's right.
Okay. And he, you know, it's interesting. He was in, of course, Savannah last weekend for St. Patrick's Day, because who would you rather drink with on St. Patrick's Day than the Vice President of the United States? And we contributed to all this angst ahead of time about how awful it was going to be. Businesses were going to shut down, people were going to lose money. I pointed out on Monday that we didn't see a lot of post St. Patrick's Day reporting on this. I'm sure some businesses within that 12-block radius that they shut things down did probably suffer a bit. But he appears to have come to Savannah and gone, and the city's none the worse for wear, unless I'm wrong, in which case I hope people in Savannah will tell me.
Yeah, and the mayor down there was able to make a personal pitch to get more federal funding to deepen the Savannah port, which has long been one of the top priorities for leadership here in Georgia. And he's coming back for the second time in a week. He's coming here on Friday, not just to raise money for Republicans at their victory dinner or whatever they call it, but also for a separate rally about the tax bill. And we're starting to see that amp up here in Georgia. We had House Speaker Paul Ryan come here a few weeks ago to meet with most of the delegation at Home Depot. Now Pence is here. It's a clear signal that we already knew Republicans will be running on that tax bill.
Yeah, but tomorrow, what we saw in that, again, we keep talking about the Pennsylvania 18, Republicans couldn't get any traction on the tax law, and in fact they within a week before the election pulled all the ads that sort of celebrated that Rick Saccone, the Republican candidate, would keep alive this notion of continuing to drive down our taxes. I know there are a lot of questions up on the Hill about whether the tax law is going to do what they hope it will, right?
I mean, the Republicans right now, you talk to them and they're projecting such confidence. They see it as such a clear win, and that, you know, give it time, give people time to see more money in their paycheck and people will come around. But at the same time, it still isn't the same wedge issue that something like immigration is. And that's what you saw Republicans pivoting toward in Pennsylvania after the tax argument didn't seem to be as inspiring to voters.
Kyle, speaking of the vice president's visit on Friday, I wonder if Nick Ayers, his chief of staff, might be flying into the state. Nick, of course, is a Georgia boy. And this is by way of doing a promotion. There was a major profile of Nick in the Huffington Post, HuffPost, a few days ago. And it talks about the rise of this young Georgia political prodigy who started out working for Sonny Perdue's gubernatorial campaign, went on to become the director of the National Republican, Association,
right?
And now is the chief of staff for Vice President Pence, and is credited in many ways with putting Pence back on a path to being viable on his own without Trump. Vicky Ward, who wrote that piece, is going to be on our show on Monday. So that'll be really fun. But what do you think? I mean, Pence is clearly, Trump is popular in Georgia. Republicans Friday night are going to give him a huge reception, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I would be shocked if anything different happened. I mean, this is still a very, within the Republican Party, certainly a very pro-Trump group. And for those members of the party who maybe just sort of hold their nose still a little bit around Donald Trump, Mike Pence is the antidote to that, right? I mean, he's the other, sort of the other side within the Republican Party that gives them maybe a link to this administration.
He's the other white
mage. More comfortable.
He's the other white mage.
That story, by the way, I mean, take an hour or so out of your day and read it, because it's long, but it's packed with information. It also shows how the operation around him. A lot of former Sonny Perdue aides, just like Nick Ayers, have gone on in Missouri and in Illinois and in other races to play a prominent role. Sonny Perdue sort of acolyte ran Eric Greitens' campaign in Missouri, and Nick Ayers helped out with that campaign as well as Bruce Rauner's campaign in Illinois. And last night, Bruce Rauner's narrowly edged out a challenger in the Republican primary in Illinois to remain a governor for now he's facing a really well-funded Democratic challenger in November.
Yep, that's going to be a great race to watch in the fall. All right. So Vicky Ward on Monday talking about the rise of Nick Ayers, who we remember, we used to kind of humor him when he was a young kid on the Purdue campaign. Isn't he a sweet kid?
He was Sonny Perdue's driver.
Right.
Really
exactly.
Early in the campaign.
Tamar, there's a lot of talk these days about Richard Shelby, who is on course to become the new chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, replacing Thad Cochran, talking about Mississippi, as we did earlier, who's retiring part of, because of health issues, unfortunately. And the question becomes, here's a shrewd, canny negotiator, a behind-the-scenes operator who could have an enormous impact, many Georgia members fear, on the way the water wars are being fought. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, first of all, I think it's worth saying up front that there are kind of two different tracks here. The main one is the legal one, being fought in several cases in court, including the Supreme Court. There's also a parallel fight on Capitol Hill to kind of nudge discussions in one way or another, and that's what we're talking about here. In the last few years, Georgia has done a pretty good job of banding together to make sure that Georgia isn't disadvantaged in this Capitol Hill game. But they are really freaked out that when Shelby becomes chairman, that could very much move the needle. And Shelby is known as kind of a bare-knuckle brawler who's willing to kind of slip things in to spending bills under the radar. And before people even realize what's in it, the bill's been passed. So people are kind of on high alert for that. And he's known to have angered Republicans, people in his own party, in similar fights over stuff like this. So
Tamar, what do you think Governor Deal feels about him?
Oh, man, I think there's some personal animosity. Deal, when he was a congressman in 2006, had to fight off an attempt that Shelby made on a bill to strip something that Georgia thought would hurt them. And I know he was really angry about it at the time. So I'm sure he's not thrilled about Shelby's promotion.
Yeah, we're talking, of course, Kyle, about the tri-state water wars, the battle between Georgia, Alabama, and Florida about who gets what from the Chattahoochee River. Metro Atlanta has, for the most part, prevailed in most of the court actions on this, in other negotiations on it, but Shelby could change that equation. And for those of you who are listening in South Georgia, if you're farmers down there, or if you're listening in Metro Atlanta, this could have a huge impact if Shelby starts working his wily ways on this process.
Well, and if you remember, one of the things that what's the title? Grandmaster in the
Special Master.
Special master.
Yeah, that didn't sound right.
He's
coming
not a chess
out. If you remember, one of the things he told Florida in that case, it was, you know, you really went after the wrong party here. You should have gone after the Corps of Engineers.
Right.
And I would expect that would be a target for if it becomes Appropriations Chairman Shelby to go after that route.
So tomorrow we will be looking for you to follow Shelby around secretly. in disguise, perhaps, to watch how he is behaving once he gets this big job, which there's not much question he is going to get this role, right?
Or at least send your hologram.
Send your hologram. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. All right. We just got a couple minutes left. And Greg, I did want to point out, we gave a little promotion to the fact that the vice president will be here Friday for the Republican state party dinner. But the Democratic state party has announced their keynote speaker, and he is?
He's also a big name in the Democratic party. Doug Jones, the newly elected Alabama senator, who gave his first floor speech today, I think.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, on gun control and banning bump stocks and high-capacity assault rifles and weapons like that. But he will be here, I think it's 2 days after the primary,
yes.
So May 24th.
Yes.
So whoever he's with will be the Democratic nominee for governor because there's only two candidates.
Yeah.
No runoff.
Yep. The dinner, which used to finally be called the Jefferson Jackson
dinner.
No longer.
I think that might also be called the victory dinner.
Yeah, those are two names Democrats have decided to put distance between themselves and for reasons that I think we probably all understand. Oh, okay, so this is fascinating, Kyle and Tamar. Jones comes in there. He's in a red state. He, you know, maybe won partly because Roy Moore was not exactly the strongest candidate to run against. And yet his first speech on the floor, according to Bluestein, is on some form of gun control. It's kind of doubling down and believing that the voters of that state might in fact be happy to have you. You know, it's a kind of a liberal position for a guy who's hanging on by a thread in Alabama because he does have to run for that seat full time this fall, right? Tomorrow?
I think he has a few more years.
Oh, that's right. He does. I apologize.
In Senate terms, you've got a long time before he has to worry about re-election.
That's absolutely right. This is why I really appreciate the smart people who come on the show to remind me. He is sort of safe for the time being. So maybe he can get away with it for now.
Or maybe he's going to try to get away with as much as he can between now and then accept that that he's going to have a really uphill battle when the time does come.
All right. I mean, that is the nice thing about being a member of the United States Senate. You've got 6 years from the day that you're elected in a regular election. You can make any number of decisions early on and not worry too much, at least for some time. So thank you for correcting me on that. We're just about out of time. Just a last quick note, Tamar. Is there any reason to think, and you've got about 20 seconds, maybe it's a yes or no, any reason to think this spending bill, deadline is on Friday night, is not going to pass? I know there's some people in the Senate who aren't thrilled with it. Is there any reason to think it won't pass?
I think we could see hijinks. It'll pass at the end of the day because it has to, but there could be drama, there could be changes.
Thank you for that brief answer, and you win the toaster oven for the final word in today's show. Tamar Hallerman, Kyle Wingfield, Greg Bluestein, what a great pleasure to have my colleagues in the print media here for Political Rewind today. Thank you in the control room there, Tom and Tyler and Olivia, for your work on the show today. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll be back with another show on Friday when we have the mayors of Columbus, Teresa Tomlinson, and the mayor of Sandy Springs, Rusty Paul. That should be an interesting show. We'll see you then at 2:00.